Here we are again at backstage at the Architect Insight 2010, and it's a great pleasure to have Steve Cook with me, software architect for the Visual Studio team, and I'm sure we'll find out more about your specific role in a moment. So Steve, thank you very much for joining us. We've just come away from the afternoon keynotes on day one, and it was great to hear what you were talking about, specifically the areas around our involvement with OMG, the Object Management Group, I think it's right. Mm-hmm. And certainly, part way through, you talked about Microsoft's engagement over the years, and I've followed, as many people, our model-driven strategy over the years. And I think, when we announced the OMG, going back into OMG, it was quite a surprise to many people on the surface. But having heard you talk today, I can completely see that it's still holds true to the kind of basic vision that Microsoft's had itself. So it's extremely exciting. But we were involved. You were saying that we were involved from the UML 1 version 1 specification, but then dropped out of favor and out of the OMG, and then 2007, I think, back in. So I guess and during that time we'd done a lot around model driven development and DSLs, domain specific languages in particular. So I guess what prompted us to go back into the OMG, what was the driving function there, and how did that come about?
Well, we rejoined it in 2008, in fact.
Apologies.
Perhaps I can go back a little further.
Absolutely,
to answer the question. As you say, well, I joined Microsoft in 2003, and previously I worked for IBM, and at IBM I had been their representative on the development of UML2, which was an interesting and actually rather uncomfortable period in my career, because UML2 was a large and rather complex and bloated thing after UML1, which I was also involved with development of. So anyway, I joined Microsoft to beef up the modeling team, so to speak. I mean, I was, I joined the modeling team and I brought quite a lot of background in modeling.
The modeling team within
Visual Studio, absolutely. Mm. And the first thing that we decided to do at that point, and that was 2003, like I said, was develop these domain-specific language modeling tools. In the industry, I think that was pretty novel, right? We were telling a story that other people weren't telling, and we made a difference doing that. I think if you look around now at modeling tools, you'll find a lot of people copying what we were doing then with DSLs. So we sort of made a different statement. We said, well, UML, we're not sure, right? We may have said some ruder things than that, actually, at that point. But what we are sure about is modeling. And we're also sure that certainly some people want to do modeling specific to the domains of that they're developing in. Mm. So we created these tools to create modeling tools, domain-specific language tools. And then I think over the last 4 or 5 years, one of the things we've observed is that people use the DSLs to create very UML-like languages. They create things that look like class diagrams, or they look like state diagrams or activity diagrams. So there's certainly intrinsic value in the things that UML brought to the table, but there's also a lot of noise in the things that UML brought to the table. So as we went through that, our customers were asking us about UML, and essentially demanding UML from us. They said, we want you to do UML. We think you've got an interesting story around modeling and how it fits into the whole development process. We the customer, want you to build UML tools. So eventually we kind of said, okay, we'll do that. And we enabled ourselves to do it through having built these DSL mm-hmm. tools, because they're the platform on which the UML tools are built. So now we've kind of got both, right? We've got the DSL tools, we've got the ability to create your own languages, we've got the UML tools built on those, so we're providing UML. And the other side of the story is joining the OMG, joining the Object Management Group, because we felt now we're implementing this standard, we actually want to improve it. Mm-hmm. We want to engage in it. I want to go back to that sort of uncomfortable period in 1999, 2000, when we were defining UML2, and actually fix the mistakes we made. So I'm very engaged at the OMG in moving the spec of UML forwards and trying to simplify it and move it into the next decade rather than the last decade.
Yeah, and the way you talked about that simplification, I think there were kind of three phases you talked about, and kind of decluttering and the re-specification and then kind of delivering,
yeah.
I guess.
Yes.
But really, what that ended up looking like, to me, was suddenly a very extensible framework that would kind of allow that sort of domain specificity. There was, I think, the richness in DSL, logical level. But it seems that this almost sort of allows that, so it's not just to redeliver UML as it currently stands, but to evolve the whole modeling paradigm.
Absolutely. Nobody wants to redeliver UML as it currently stands. Yeah. There's no point. There's no added value.
I guess there is the problem of the poor interoperability, as you talked about. So I think that's an important thing to kind of reflect upon.
Well, we've got to move it forwards. We've got to retain the value that there is. We've got to really sort of pick out the real juice in UML and the thing that people value about it and retain that, and at the same time provide the ability for people to integrate it better with all new things that might come along, like DSLs, other ways of it, other things that you might integrate in the software process, other areas that UML doesn't cover. Rather than UML being this sort of fortress, I think I called it a fortress, it's this thing that has a tool, right? And it's, you buy UML and then you have to worry about how it integrates with everything else. To make that much more lightweight, make UML much, I think of it as unbundling UML. Right, so if you want class diagrams, great. They're standard, they're interoperable, but it's not a big heavyweight investment to do that.
Well, it leverages the principle of DSLs itself, doesn't it? Because in a sense, it's saying this is I'll give you a poor definition of DSL, so apologies for that. But it's applied to the domain that it's specific to, and it uses the traits of that domain. Classic of a UI. Having drag and drop of controls that you would see, that kind of WYSIWYG kind of model makes sense for that domain.
So it's a pre-canned extensible DSL for doing these jobs.
You should be able to pick
these
up and just start using them.
Absolutely.
The adoption curve should be very minimal.
Yes.
As a consequence, and you can decide how much of that toolkit and whose toolkit you use with the freedom to navigate across them. I think that's great because it provides choice and freedom for developers and for organizations to adopt to the right level that they require.
We are talking about the future here, right? We have a way to get from here to there, right?
I don't want to fall into the realm of dreaming, but no, absolutely. So I think I take your point. I think it's worth pulling us back to today. And so today we've implemented the 2.0 spec?
2.1.
And is that full implementation or is that partial?
It's a partial implementation. Right. We implemented five diagrams, class and diagrams, use case, sequence, activity, and component diagrams.
Right, and they're the, as I think you misquoted our friend Eva Jakobsen, but he corrected you, and it was the 20% that covers 90% of situations.
Yeah.
So would that be fair to say?
Well, I think it's a little more than 20%, actually, but it certainly, the way we chose those was by listening to what customers say they want, and that's been validated by the reaction to the product. It is the subset that covers most of what people normally want to do with UML.
Yeah, I think is remarkable. It's a good step for Microsoft. I think certainly the people I work with are applauding that move. That there are tools that people have grown up with, and they like them or hate them. They still. It's hard to find alternatives for the scope that they describe. I wonder, fear of going too far forwards, but I sort of talk to enterprise architects, other architects in the enterprise space who aren't immersed in software development directly. They see the outcome of those. They have to manage the repercussions of those deliveries, but they're trying to sort of model the enterprise. And if we think about some of the concepts that we talked about earlier. With the unbundling of the enterprise, the wanting to take services from multiple sources, multi-sourcing was a phrase that was used. Is there any aspirations to kind of break out of the world of just the software layer into modeling it higher levels of abstraction?
Absolutely. Mm. I mean, completely. In our current product, we have tools which are not UML tools because there are areas that UML clearly doesn't cover.
Mm.
The one that immediately comes to mind is we have a tool called the layer diagram, which is an architectural dependency graph, essentially. Mm. It's a very, very simple tool, but it's directly connected to the code in the sense that you can define dependencies, mm. which are valid and not valid, and you can validate that your code actually, you know, conforms to these dependencies, mm. and you validate your code architecturally.
Yeah.
And there's a huge road we could travel down there in terms of building abstractions, like you said, of systems at various levels of abstraction, going right out to the enterprise, and mm. including business modeling and, you know, the works, and try mm. and put it all together. And we haven't done that in our current product, but I would like to think of our product as it evolves as an evolving modeling and visualization platform, right? Mm. So we got DSLs, we got UML, we could have other kinds of models, and it's very important to me to make it actually easy and cheap to implement new abstractions onto the platform, mm. so that if there are new abstractions that people find useful, it's not going to cost us much or partners much or even the customers themselves much to implement and integrate those things.
Mm.
So, you know, absolutely.
I'm delighted to hear that. Mm. You know, that's a great aspiration to have, and I applaud that. I think I'm going to ask you this question, and feel free to respond in any way.
Sure.
But the buzz in the world of buzz that all of us frequent in IT is all awash with cloud,
mm.
and it wouldn't be right if I didn't just ask you the cloud question. You know, in the world of modeling, it probably relates to the previous question in a sense, because if we're looking to kind of take these different sort of paradigm services that are external, hosted, mm. and everything else, is that a forcing function for you? Do you need to respond to that in terms of providing development platforms and tooling, modeling tools to build cloud level solutions?
Well, I think there's several levels at which you can think about that question, actually, and it's probably a long discussion, but there's one level at which we think about you want to build basically service oriented applications, right? Mm. Or service oriented or services and the things that talk to them and deploy them. Well, there's modeling all over that. Mm. You know, there's modeling in the requirements for the services, there's modeling in how you actually construct them physically, there's certainly modeling in how you deploy them. There's lots, and we're looking hard at what's involved in that and how you manage them. There's another area which is about cloud standardization. I mean, you know, one of the real, I think, lively conversations at the moment is around cloud standardization, which I think by and large the vendors are not doing much about, and the customers want a lot of, mm. right? Because the customers mm. don't want to be locked in, right? So modeling has definitely got a place in cloud standardization. Now, because it's such a new area and such a kind of growth area and such a competitive area, we're not going to see that, you know, immediately, but no. I think there's a real force there that within the next year or two,
yeah.
we're going to start to see models playing a part there as well.
Yeah, I mean, whenever you talk about kind of cloud, it's either secure, you know, it's always security,
mm.
And the other one is how much is it going to cost, and that's where I think modeling's got a very interesting role to play, because, you know, as soon as that services running on that cloud, you're paying money. The meter's running, I like to say, and your CFO, everybody can see that meter running. So how you design and architect your system, whether you use asynchronous roles and processes to build your application, will have a different effect on the cost model depending on how much load is required by each part.
Mm.
And having ways to model these things up front to say, well, if I built my system this way with many different role instances and scale them this way against a workload, you know, that type of scenario, kind of, you know, testing against a model would be very useful, even at this stage in terms of cloud adoption.
Yes, well, I think being able to being able to catch up with those problems needs the modelling platform to be more agile.
Right.
Right. This is definitely, like I was saying in the talk, one thing we're trying to do around the OMG is just remove layers of unnecessary, you know, technicality around how you define these things, so that when you do need to express new domains, it just becomes a lot easier and cheaper and quicker. Because, you know, UML says nothing about cloud. It was invented, you know, before cloud was dreamed of.
Absolutely, yeah. No, and to providing that extensible, interoperable, agile platform for modelling is really where you think, well, where we're seeing the OMG moving towards. Would that be a fair enough statement?
Yes, yeah, so there's lots of people around the OMG who want to do that.
That's great.
The difficulty is doing it, right?
Yes,
you know, there are procedures to go through and everyone's got to agree and all the usual stuff.
But, benefit of standards, hey?
Yes, but well, you know, it's...
But in terms of our involvement, then we're pretty much, you know, we're firmly involved. It's not just something we're doing lightly, it seems to me.
We are firmly involved,
And so I guess that we can expect to see much come out of this. Where should we have a look? Where should we go to find out what the current state of developments are at OMG, or to get involved if our organisations have an investment, are wanting to kind of support this new notion or this resurgent? I mean, it's a resurgent view of OMG. I mean, I perhaps have a jaded view. It seems to me it's a very healthy, resurgent, you know, forward-looking view at OMG.
Well, I hope so. Well, I like to think so. certainly my part of it. The obvious place to go to find out what's going on the OMG is the OMG website and all the announcements on there, which announces all the meetings and activities and so forth.
Excellent.
And, you know, I have a blog and we announce stuff and...
Right.
You know, I think it's easy to find out what's going on, to be honest.
So just have a search for Steve Cook and OMG and away you go.
Take it from there, absolutely. Yeah,
absolutely. Well, thank you for that. That was really, really exciting and really interesting to hear where we're going and in tandem with OMG. I think that's, you know, that's perfect news. So thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Matt.